This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, at Google Play Music, or anywhere else you like to listen to podcasts. And when you can, rate and review us wherever you're listening to us from. Today, I'm talking with Jonathan Adler. He's a law professor at Case Western in Cleveland, Ohio, and we're talking about Brett Kavanaugh. John, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be here.
And you're, of course, also a very prolific blogger at the Vala Conspiracy, now under the umbrella of Reason.com. So you can check out a lot of John's writing at the Vala Conspiracy at Reason.com. So, John, real quickly, Brett Kavanaugh, did your heart skip a beat for joy, or are you a little bit sad about him being the Donald Trump's second nominee for the Supreme Court?
I'm closer to the former. I mean, I wouldn't say that I swoon very often over judicial nominations, but I think he's a very strong nomination. He's very qualified. And in particular, his qualifications address some issues that I'm particularly concerned about related to the administrative state. So I think it was a strong pick. I think that as much as I and others have been critical of this administration on a wide range of issues, when it's come to appellate judicial nominees and Supreme Court nominees, his record appears to be pretty good so far. And I think the Kavanaugh pick is a continuation of that.
So let me ask you first, could you briefly describe your attitude or your judicial philosophy vis-a-vis the administrative state? And then why is Kavanaugh a good pick?
Sure. So, generally on constitutional matters, I consider myself to be an originalist, someone that believes that the Constitution as a written document has the meaning it had when it was adopted. And that it's the public meaning, it's not some secret code, but the meaning that the people that ratified the Constitution and subsequent amendments would have understood what they're ratifying had. Also, when it comes to statutes, I consider myself a textualist. The text of a statute is what goes through bicameralism and presentment. That is what Congress enacts and the president signs.
So, just to put a bow on the textual originalism, I mean, basically what you're saying, and I realize I spend a lot of time in libertarian land, so this kind of stuff is, I wouldn't say old news to me, but it seems obvious that laws mean what they say. It's not always easy to understand that, but then you use recourse back to what was going on around when a law was adopted to understand its intention. And then when it comes to the administrative state or to government agencies and bureaucracies, if Congress passes a law that says, this agency should be doing this, that actually has effect on how that agency or bureaucracy or bureau goes about its business.
Precisely. Okay. Agencies don't have any special place in our system. Agencies exist because Congress authorizes them, because Congress appropriates money to them, and Congress delegates power to them. They have no inherent powers. So I think an important starting point in thinking about agencies is, what power were they actually given? What rules did Congress enact to constrain those agencies? Now, I should note, there is an active debate among legal scholars and certainly among libertarian legal scholars about whether there are constitutional limits on how much power agencies can be given. And folks like Gary Lawson have written some important work on that. I think that's an important debate. It's not one that's particularly live in the Supreme Court right now, although that might change. But a very important principle, and one that I think that Judge Kavanaugh's record reflects, is that agencies aren't given blank checks to go out and do good. They're given the authority to do specific things in specific ways. And we should make sure when they are acting that they are acting within the scope of that authority.
So what's an example, for you front and center, what's kind of the most egregious example, or maybe not an egregious, just a really good illustration of the administrative state kind of gone wild, where it is doing more. that it
right.
should
so some
be.
Examples that from his record, when the so-called open internet order, net neutrality, mm-hmm. was challenged in the D.C. Circuit, he dissented from the denial of en banc review in that case, and he said, "Look, Congress gave the FCC authority over certain technologies and industries when it enacted the Communications Act, and it did not give the FCC the authority to regulate the internet, to declare internet service providers to be utilities. And while it might be possible for the FCC to play clever linguistic games with the text of the statute to bootstrap that sort of argument, if we start from the standpoint that agencies only have the authority that was delegated to them, one of the things that goes with that is that Congress doesn't write blank checks in the footnotes. Congress delegates authority clearly. And if there is doubt about authority, especially when you're talking about something as consequential as, declaring internet service providers are public utilities for purposes of federal regulation, we need some clear indication that Congress was in fact giving that authority. And he said, the tie doesn't go to the agency. For a question this large, the tie goes back to Congress, and it's Congress's job.
Could you also put that in the context of EPA regulations? Because I know you do a lot of work in, yes. related to environmentalism, and the Environmental Protection Agency is clearly, one of the things that everybody, whether you're pro-Kavanaugh or anti-Kavanaugh, people are nervous about. How does the EPA exceed what you would consider its legitimate congressional, permit of powers?
Right. So he wrote actually a somewhat similar decision in a case involving one of the Obama administration's greenhouse gas regulations. After the Supreme Court, in a case called Massachusetts versus EPA, declared that greenhouse gases could be regulated as air pollutants under the Clean Air Act, the Obama administration began rolling out various regulatory measures to implement that. And some of them were very aggressive. And for one set of rules that the Obama administration issued, they had a problem. And that problem was that when you read the plain text of the Clean Air Act, if you applied certain provisions to greenhouse gases, you would create a mess because you would no longer be regulating utilities and large industrial facilities. Hmm. You'd be regulating restaurants and hotels and apartment buildings and the like. I actually did a piece in Reason Magazine several years back that talked about some of this. You would basically be giving the EPA a job that it does not have the personnel to do, does not have the technical capacity to do, and would transform a part of the Clean Air Act that was written to address the big, heavily polluting, large industrial facilities into something that would regulate millions of buildings throughout the country. And he wrote an opinion saying, the EPA, and then to make matters worse, the way the EPA was going to solve that problem was not by saying, maybe this provision just doesn't apply to greenhouse gases because it can't. EPA's solution was to say, let's rewrite this provision. And where Congress has given us specific numerical thresholds for what is or is not a regulated facility, we're just going to literally rewrite those numbers. So instead of 100 tons per year, we'll rewrite that to be 25,000 tons per year or something. And Judge Kavanaugh said, it doesn't work that way. If an agency in trying to apply an old statutory provision to a new problem discovers that that produces really crazy pants results, then the agency should probably go back and consider, were we really given the power to do this in the first place? The last thing an agency should do is claim that it has the power to pull out its own red pen and rewrite the statute. And that's what the EPA tried to do. Judge Kavanaugh wrote a dissent saying they can't do that. His opinion was ultimately upheld or ultimately vindicated by the Supreme Court, which issued an opinion, largely following many of his arguments, saying the EPA as an agency doesn't get to rewrite its own statutory authority.
Does anybody seriously, and I guess this, I'm asking you to, you know, read the intentions of people, I guess, which is always a tricky thing. But do people seriously argue that agencies really are these kind of autonomous, you know, entities that have the right to revise their mission whenever they want to? Or is that only political expediency? Because, you know, there are times when it's a, you know, if it's a Republican in the White House with a Democratic Congress, you know, I mean, certainly George Bush was no, you know, no enemy, no principled enemy of administrative, of executive branch overreach. Obama, certainly not. I mean, does anybody seriously say, no, you know what, the EPA gets to reset its, you know, its paradigm every couple of years?
There are some. I mean, they might not use that precise language, but you certainly see that. So in the greenhouse gas case I just mentioned, Justice Breyer wrote a dissent that basically said, well, the statute's about drawing a line between big polluters and small polluters. And yeah, Congress wrote that line in numerical terms, but it was really about big versus little. And as long as EPA is doing big versus little, you know, we should give them a pass. I find that pretty horrific, because I think when Congress is, you know, when Congress takes the time to specify a numerical threshold, that's the law, and we should follow that.
You're not also saying, you know, whatever Congress does, you know, majority rules, this and that. I mean, it's just, it, you know, when we're talking about specific legislation that empowers agencies or gives them the right authority to do certain things, come on, we got to be bound by the language, right?
Exactly. And you know, members of Congress, you know, get the fancy dinners and the fun pins to put on their lapels, because it's their job to write the laws, and if the laws don't work, to amend them. And we may not like all the laws they pass, but in the first instance, it's their job. And so long as the laws they enact are constitutional, that's what courts should do. In terms of your question, though, I think, you know, you hit on something that I think is important when it relates to delegation of power to agencies, which is there's a lot of political expedience, right? The Obama administration believed it was easier to try and effectively rewrite the Clean Air Act through the regulatory process than to get Congress to amend the law. And to be fair, the Bush administration did something very similar. The Bush administration wanted to change certain parts of air pollution regulation. They decided they would have a hard time getting that through Congress, so they tried to do it administratively. And like the Obama administration, when those cases got to court, they lost a lot of them because the federal court said, you don't get to do that. But there's political expedience there.
Sure. And with the open internet order, with net neutrality, you actually had a federal judge kind of giving, saying, hey, you know, FCC, why don't you try it this way? If you switch the regulatory provisions under which internet service providers are considered or data providers. So
it
gets even more tangled. Yes. So
I should just add real quickly, we have to keep in mind that Congress often likes this, right?
Sure.
Members of Congress like getting to punt the tough issues to agencies. So when we hold agencies to the limits of the authority they've actually been given, that's not just about disciplining agencies. It's also about forcing members of Congress to be accountable for the power they have delegated. And if, you know, the EPA or the FCC or some other agency was not given the right amount or too much or too little or whatever authority, we shouldn't let members of Congress sit back and say, oh, well, the agency should figure it out.
Just want
courts to send it back so that members of Congress have to explain to us, their constituents, why they are supporting or opposing that.
And so I'm going to mangle stuff. I want to have a quick sidebar, attorney Adler here, and just say, when, as a kind of side issue to questions about the administrative state, you know, we've been talking about you know, the FCC and regulatory, you know, regimes of how you deal with data processing versus voice and this type of stuff. There was a massive telecom rewrite or updating of telecommunication laws in the mid 90s. Much of it was terrible. And thankfully, you know, the worst parts of it on freedom of speech grant or, you know, affecting internet speech were struck down by the Supreme Court. The EPA, which only came into being, I guess, in the early 70s, and the Clean Air Act, these were major pieces of legislation. Have we just passed out of an era where Congress is willing or capable of writing this kind of legislation in a bipartisan way? Obviously, we have things like Dodd-Frank. We have things like Obamacare. We, you know, the Bush administration muscled through, you know, a bunch of things early on. But, I mean, how much, you know, so Congress is the problem. This is a hobby horse that I will ride all the way to the glue factory. But, you know, are we just past the point of Congress being functional at all?
I don't think we're past the point. And I think one way you force Congress to do its job is not letting it off the hook. And so that having people on the Supreme Court who care about these principles is a way of saying to Congress, you're going to have to fix these problems. And, you know, we have seen examples of, you know, when the Department of Veteran Affairs scandals were heating up, Congress passed very quickly some reform measures. Now, I don't know enough about that area to know if the reforms they passed were good or bad. What I do know is that when Congress realized there was no one else to do it, you know, they put on their big boy pants and did the job. And I think we want judges that you know, enforce those limits. And of course, also, you know, we should not forget, we also want judges that will police Congress when Congress exceeds its constitutional authority. I mean, that's obviously very important too. But I think that is a necessary step to having a Congress that actually functions as a legislature.
So, you know, as we're talking about the kind of Supreme Court justices we want or one should want, you know, one of the things we're going to be hearing about is how, you know, Brett Kavanaugh is uniquely disqualified for this position because of X, Y, and Z. Just on a, you know, and this is a guy who's already out of, he's already an appellate judge, you know, with a long record and whatnot. But is there any grounds apart from partisanship to say that Kavanaugh is not qualified to be on the Supreme Court? Doesn't mean he should be on it or anything, but like, I mean, this, there's, you know, this is not Harriet Myers territory.
No, I know. Yeah. But, you know, by any kind of objective standard of qualifications, you know, he is supremely qualified, extensive experience, not only on a federal court, but in the executive branch, as well as in private practice, had three federal clerkships, including his clerkship for Justice Kennedy. You know, he checks all the boxes of the qualifications. And he's gone through Senate confirmation before. He's gone through multiple FBI background checks. I would be surprised if anything emerges that would be disqualifying. Now, are there things about his record that reasonable people might find more or less favorable? Of course. Are there things about his record that libertarians may like more than others? Of course. I think, you know, by any objective standard of qualifications, you know, he's way up there.
What is the, you know, from a libertarian point of view, you know, what's the most offensive thing that Kavanaugh has done, or what's the worst habit of mind that he has that we should be worried about?
Well, so I think the biggest concerns from a libertarian perspective would be the following. One is, it's not clear where on the conservative spectrum he falls on questions of the constitutional protections of criminal defendants. As listeners may know, on the right side of the Supreme Court, there has been a dispute or a divide between folks who might call formalists like the late Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas on the one hand, and pragmatists like Justice Kennedy, who's just retiring, and, right, and Justice Alito on the other. The former's view is, if there is a protection in the Constitution, like the warrant requirement, like the right to confront witnesses against you and so on, that gets enforced to the letter, no qualifications, no exceptions, period. The pragmatist's view is, well, none of these are absolute, and we have to take into account the realities of the criminal justice system and so on. I don't think we know a lot about where where a Justice Kavanaugh would fall on that spectrum. I'm more sympathetic to the formalist approach, both because I think that is a better reading of the relevant constitutional provisions, as well as because I think it produces some more libertarian results. But I don't think we know entirely where he falls there. So that's one area where libertarians might have some concern. A second area might be about executive power in the area of national security and the like. As a veteran of the Bush administration, as a judge on the D.C. Circuit, Judge Kavanaugh has not appeared to be particularly sympathetic to, for example, habeas claims brought by enemy combatants. I should say, as a constitutional matter, I'm not sure he's wrong. The libertarian in me is a little uncomfortable with some of that, but the constitutional law professor in me says the Constitution is not a perfectly libertarian document. There are aspects of it that give government more power than I might like, and that power has to be restrained through the political process. I think that Judge Kavanaugh's record in some areas of executive power leans in that direction, and I certainly would understand why libertarians might be uncomfortable with that. I think he's probably correct as a pure originalist matter, but I do understand why and share some of the concerns about how some of that power could be misused.
How do you think how would he fit in to the current mix? Because he's one thing on his own or with his own opinions, but then with Kennedy leaving, some observers and certainly my colleague Peter Suderman at Reason talks a lot about this, about how Kennedy goes from being the swing vote, he's obviously gone, but then it becomes John Roberts or something like that. How does Kavanaugh fit into the spread of justices? And would he be, is he a good kind of flavor to be adding to the stew here? Or is he too much like somebody else on the court already? Or is that a good thing?
Yeah, so I think that first, Peter is absolutely right the focal point of power in the court is going to shift from Kennedy to Roberts. Not only will Roberts often be the median justice, but as Chief Justice, he will have he has the power to assign opinions, and he will be in the majority in the vast majority of cases, and he will have the power to decide who writes the opinion, which can have a big effect on how the law is shaped. So this will, the first 13 years of the Roberts Court were in many ways the Kennedy Court. From this point forward, I think it will truly be the Roberts Court. In terms of adding Kavanaugh, I think there's some things that are worth noting. One is, I may have mentioned already, there are a bunch of his opinions on the D.C. Circuit, including quite a few dissents, that the Supreme Court has subsequently vindicated. Cases where he wrote a dissent, and it's pretty clear that his dissent is one of the reasons the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case, and then a majority of the Supreme Court ultimately adopted his view. And what that says to me is that he will join the court as someone that is already highly respected and listened to by many of the justices. And that, I think, means he will have a bigger impact than you might expect a junior justice to have. And I think that's a good thing.
And he's 50 years old, right? So he's going to be around for another 150 years, if my other Reason colleague, Ron Bailey, is right about increasing lifespans.
Yes. And the other thing is, I think that, I think a lot of libertarians like, for example, some of the broad sweeps of, say, some of the things Justice Gorsuch has written about the administrative state. There's real value to having someone that has been in those trenches, that has been on the D.C. Circuit as long as he has, that has written well over 100 administrative law opinions, that has really been waist deep in these questions and dealing with the nitty gritty details. And I think that is something that you don't really have on the court. And the last person that really had that degree of expertise and knowledge about administrative law, especially on the right side of the court, was Justice Scalia. Mm. And Justice Scalia actually got some of those questions wrong.
I guess you mentioned it before, Stephen Breyer, to a certain degree, has a lot. Yeah, I mean, he's on the other side of the issue, but right. So here, let me ask you this, then. Is this, I mean, you know, Trump, you know, and, you know, I think about Trump almost every day, unfortunately. I try not to, but, you know, he's like an obsessive compulsive disorder all of his own. But, you know, one of the things that Steve Bannon said, that, you know, Trump was going to deconstruct the administrative state. Is Kavanaugh, you know, following Gorsuch, you know, is this the one thing that Trump is definitely delivering on, do you think, assuming that he goes through and is put to the court, on the court?
He's certainly delivering on nominating highly qualified, highly intelligent right of center jurists to both appellate courts and the Supreme Court. I think that the Kavanaugh appointment does suggest that the administration recognizes that having that degree of administrative law expertise on the court is necessary. You know, whether or not the administration is going to deliver on deconstructing the administrative state also depends on what occurs in the agencies. And mm-hmm. and there, I think the record's more mixed in the sense that, you know, some folks, including the recently departed head of EPA, didn't realize that, you know, if you want to undo regulations and you want to survive court challenges to those actions and so on, you can't do that quick and dirty. You've really got to roll up your sleeves.
Would you say somebody like Ajit Pai at the FCC, the way that he rolled back net neutrality, that's a model for how an agency should do it?
Yes. So, right. So in some agencies like the FCC, I think you've seen an understanding that courts expect you to do the work. You can't just do a press release. You actually have to go through the various steps and show you've thought about the various considerations. Again, the FCC generally has done that. Some other agencies, the EPA, are still a work in progress in that mm-hmm. regard. And, you know, someone like a Justice Kavanaugh is, if an agency does the work and they're acting within their statutory authority, a Justice Kavanaugh is going to say, go for it. But if they're being sloppy about it, even if they're moving in a direction that a Justice Kavanaugh might mm-hmm. like, I would expect him to say, no, that's not how this system works. You're supposed to, you know, Congress has required you to take certain steps. You have to take those steps.
Quickly, explain what Chevron deference is. And are we going to be done with that terrible term sometime in the near future, again, assuming Kavanaugh gets put on the court?
Yeah, so Chevron deference is this idea that when Congress enacts a very complicated statute that is ambiguous in certain respects, that ambiguity should often be understood as a delegation of power to the agency to resolve that ambiguity and fill in the gaps. And so the idea is, if the statute is clear, you follow the statute. If it's not clear, provided certain other conditions are met, you defer to the agency. In practice, and Justice Kennedy highlighted this in one of his last concurring opinions on the court, in practice, a lot of time this kind of means, well, if it's really complicated and messy, just do what the agency wants. That's not how a Justice Kavanaugh will approach these questions. You know, is he a vote to get rid of Chevron completely? Not so sure. Is he a vote to make sure that Chevron is not an excuse for judges to just give agencies blank checks? Absolutely. And in that, I think he's in line with Justice Kennedy, in line with Chief Justice Roberts, who's written some important opinions, including an important dissent in a case called Arlington, about how we don't let agencies define the scope of their own authority, that's just not how it works, and that Chevron's not an excuse for that. And I definitely think that a Justice Kavanaugh would agree with that principle, and that would do a lot towards, you know, ensuring greater accountability within the administrative state.
You know, in many ways, and now that I think about it, I haven't done an actual count, but in many regards, the Supreme Court, you know, looks more like America than it traditionally has. There's, you know, there's men, there's women, there's different ethnicities. There are different ages and people coming from different backgrounds. Is there any concern, or do you have any concern? You went to Yale as an undergrad, so I assume that you're, you know, you always want to see somebody from your alma mater, get on the court. You did go to George Mason, now called the Antonin Scalia Law School, for your juris degree. But is there a problem when everybody on the court comes from one or one and a half schools? Is there any reason to be concerned about that?
Sure. I think that, having a wider range of experiences is useful on the court. And I think I would include in that understanding different parts of the country, as mm-hmm. well as perhaps having a different educational experience and educational backgrounds. Mm-hmm. There are some areas where there are conspicuous absences on the court. I mean, Justice Gorsuch, as a geographical matter, is like the one non-Northeast corridor justice.
He went to high school in Bethesda, for God's sake.
He did,
right?
And he
was classmates with Kavanaugh. I mean, this is like it's like Chevy Chase Bethesda. It's not even Montgomery County writ large.
Right. So I do think, having some of that geographical diversity, because, the way, for example, you view certain environmental cases or certain cases relating to what it means for the federal government to be the dominant landowner is different if you've actually seen that. The other area that's missing on the court that I think is a big deficiency, and one that I don't think is going to be fixed anytime soon, is there's no one on the court who's done real work as a criminal defense attorney. And there are a bunch of former prosecutors,
of course,
which, is valuable experience. But, especially when it comes to, appellate challenges to convictions, to, post-conviction review in habeas proceedings and the like, having someone that has defended, someone that's accused of rape or murder or whatever, so not even white collar defense, but real traditional criminal defense. I think that's a very important perspective. I think sometimes when you read some of the criminal law decisions of the Supreme Court, you sense that they don't really understand how some of these things work in practice. So that sort of experience and state court experience, I think, are types of experience that, if it were up to me, I would love to see on the court. And Judge Kavanaugh, for his other virtues, and I think there are quite a few, he doesn't help us fill in those deficiencies, and that's too bad. And hopefully some of that will be fixed in the future.
Two of the things that are getting bandied about as a reason to be against Kavanaugh, or just to be nervous about him, has to do with abortion rights, particularly rules emanating from Roe versus Wade. As well as gay marriage or same-sex marriage, which was essentially, created by the Supreme Court. Are there reasons to believe that he will accelerate, the end of those social realities? Or is it true that he will likely, if these cases come up in various ways, he'll be the one saying, these need to be decided by Congress, not by or state legislatures, not by, the Supreme Court?
Well, going in reverse order, I don't think same-sex marriage is going anywhere. Walter Olson had a really good piece in the Wall Street Journal this week explaining why. I agree 100%. This is for a bunch of reasons. One is, just where popular opinion is. I'm not even sure a case is going to arise. I mean, maybe something will come out of Alabama, but, I'm not sure what case.
The last thing that came out of Alabama was, I guess Roy Moore never made it out, so it's Jeff Sessions. So
thankfully,
hopefully we won't be hearing too much from Alabama. And I mean that the football team as well.
Right.
I hate Alabama in all of its particulars, but continue.
But I think that when you think about the traditional things that the court looks at when considering overturning a precedent, one of the factors is whether or not there are real reliance interests. And the reality is, when millions of Americans are planning their lives around the existence of same-sex marriage as a legal institution, the reliance interests are really, really very strong. So I can't imagine the Supreme Court's going to overturn Obergefell, and I doubt Justice Kavanaugh would be a vote.
So what about Roe versus Wade, though? Because before 1973, right? I mean, a lot of people were planning their lives around the availability of legal abortion.
Yeah, although the time horizons are shorter there. Now, I think that's a harder question. I mean, on the one hand, you know, you've had Republican presidents saying they want to appoint justices that'll overturn Roe for the last, 35 years. And while Roe has been narrowed a little bit, it has not been overturned. I think a Justice Kavanaugh is likely to have, shall we say, a stingy view of what Casey provides for. Casey is a later decision from the 1990s that preserved the core of Roe. It recognized a constitutional right for a woman to terminate her pregnancy, but subject to some limits by state legislatures. And since then, the Supreme Court has gone back and forth on how tightly or how strictly to interpret that opinion. I think he would be on the side of giving states a little more leeway. Whether or not he is willing to overturn it completely, I don't know. I'm not sure anyone knows. It would have been inappropriate for the White House to ask him that question. And my understanding is that they did not. It would also have been inappropriate for him to answer, in the sense that any potential judge who would commit to how ahead of time how they would vote is not fit for the position. So I think there's a real question there. I think it is difficult to defend Roe as a matter of original public meaning of the Constitution. Not impossible. There are some libertarian-oriented originalists who have made the case. But it is also the sort of question that does implicate serious questions about stare decisis and precedent. And this is a court that in recent years has been very reluctant to overturn precedent. We got a bunch this term in the case about public sector unions and the case about taxing out-of-state retailers. But that was unusual. I mean, the Roberts Court overturns prior Supreme Court decisions at a significantly lower rate than the Rehnquist Court, Berger Court, or Warren Court. So I think it's an open question of what this nomination means for Roe. And so we'll have to see.
Two final questions. One of the other things, and it's really a term of opprobrium tossed out by opponents of Donald Trump, which include many Republicans as well as Democrats, many conservatives as well as liberals. But, Kavanaugh was on that list put together by the Federalist Society. Yeah. Now, you, about 15 years ago almost, you received a major award from the Federalist Society. You are a proud member in good standing. What's the quick rebuttal to people who envision, the Federalist Society as this shadowy cabal like Ben Franklin's Junto Club? That is secretly or openly pulling strings. Why is that wrong?
Well, so I mean, on so many levels. I mean, one is anyone can join. The National Convention, other meetings are out in the open. It's an organization that has people that disagree quite strongly on a wide range of constitutional issues. Folks like Randy Barnett and Ilya Sohman on the libertarian end, to people like Michael Paulson on the more traditional conservative end. There is no single Federalist Society party line. And then when it comes to the lists, we have to remember what the history of the list was, right? Donald Trump was running for president. A lot of people, myself included, I did not support his election, didn't believe that he would appoint good judicial nominees.
Yeah, he was talking about appointing his sister, right?
Right.
At one point.
And literally what happened was the campaign was like, we need a list. we need to do something to calm the nerves of people that don't think they can support us. And a handful of folks at the Federalist Society, the Heritage Foundation, quickly came up with some names of people that are just generally well respected. And I know several members of the initial list that the first they knew of this was when they were getting calls from the media saying, you're on this list of Supreme Court shortlisters put out by Trump. And they're like, oh, so there was no interview process. There was no, blood oath or anything like that. It's a list of widely respected conservative and libertarian jurists that have shown a commitment to originalism and textualism and judging the way that people in that general you know, out of ideological realm tend to think it is appropriate. And that's why Brett Kavanaugh got added to the list. And you know, that's hardly, in my view, a bad thing. You know, if it were the case that the president, White House counsel Don McGahn, Leonard Leo, someone like that, actually was questioning these people and forcing them to check off certain boxes or committing to certain outcomes, that would be a problem. I can assure folks that's not what occurred. There is a broad recognition that sort of thing would be inappropriate. And so I don't view it as any kind of a mark against him that, you know, people that generally share his judicial philosophy recognized the quality of the work he's been doing.
So a final question, you know, Obama had a shot at putting somebody on the Supreme Court, and he was denied it through a procedural move by cocaine Mitch McConnell. you know, and obviously the politics are different because the Republicans control the Senate. So they get, you know, they can put this through before the midterms and all of that. It'll be tight and all of that kind of stuff. But was that procedure by Mitch McConnell, you know, it's strictly legal, I guess, but was it wise in the sense that it, you know, it undermines in many ways, it seems to me, as somebody who's neither a Republican nor a Democrat, you know, it undermines the seriousness of the Senate and of a process that we have grown to understand. And it's also the Republicans could have just said, no, we don't want Obama's appointment, but then they would have been on the record. I mean, but what is your sense of that? Was it, you know, is it, it's legally, it was okay, but was it a good thing?
You know, I have very mixed feelings. So as a general matter, I tend to think that elections have consequences, that, the choice, or giving the president the ability to identify the person for a court, and to only have the Senate being in a role of consenting or not consenting was deliberate and wise. You know, you look at some of these nomination hearings and the sort of questioning that we see, and it's an embarrassment. And the idea that that's how we would pick our judges should be terrifying. Conversely, I know more about what goes on in Republican administrations than Democratic ones, but the sort of questioning people get beyond like FBI background check sorts of questions are questions about judicial philosophy or about how you approach these questions, not about, you know, specific cases. And I think that's a good thing. And again, Alexander Hamilton wrote a Federalist talking about the dynamic where he suggested that, in fact, would be the difference we would see in how the White House approaches these sorts of things and the Senate does. So I generally think the White House, as long as they're not picking a crony, as long as they're not, you know, picking the president's golf buddy or someone like that, should be fairly deferential. And I think that means giving prompt consideration to nominees. So I did not agree with the decision to not give Merrick Garland a vote. That said, this was not the first blood spilled on this. Mm-hmm. You can go back to 1988 when President Reagan nominated Pam Reimer to the Ninth Circuit and a woman named Judith Hope to the D.C. Circuit. Those two picks would have swung the partisan balance on both of those courts from majority Democrat to majority Republican. And the Senate Democrats said, we are not going to hold a hearing or a vote on either one of them, precisely because they believed that Michael Dukakis would be the next president or that a Democrat would be the next president. Now, they were wrong, but they did it precisely for that reason. And since then, we've seen that happen repeatedly. We saw it happen again in 91 and 92 when Democrats did it again to Republicans. We saw Republicans do that to Democrats in 2000. And the reality is we had not seen a Supreme Court nominee confirmed in a presidential election year when the Senate was controlled by the opposite party. And since like the 19th century. So there really wasn't any controlling precedent. Justices, with the exception of Earl Warren in 1968, knew not to step down in a presidential election year.
Oh, and he was being pushed, right? I mean, by like any number.
There was some push, yes. And you know, we were spared the political maelstrom of a significant justice or a potentially pivotal justice dying or becoming infirm in a presidential election year, as happened with Scalia. So you know, I would prefer a world in which every nominee gets prompt consideration, every nominee gets a prompt up or down vote. That's what, you know, the institutional side of me, the side of me that really takes the long view about our constitutional structure, would have preferred that with Merrick Garland. Kind of the more, you know, realpolitik observer of me in me says, look, this was going to happen. And if the roles had been reversed, we would have seen the exact same thing happen as Obama's own White House counsel admitted in perhaps an unguarded moment during that controversy, that the Democrats would have done the exact same thing. And to me, that's just a sign of, you know, how poisonous the partisan bickering.
So you're in when you're going to help me. You'll chip in for gas and we can go drive to Canada, right? A country that has legalized marijuana, didn't have a financial crisis like ours, and seems to be working pretty well. I don't know, except for all these tariffs they're facing now from the U.S.
Yeah, and I'm you know, as much as I may not be a fan of the ACA, I'm not sure I prefer Canada's health care system.
Yeah, you got that. Well, thank you, Jonathan Adler. This has been the Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. We've been talking with Jonathan Adler. He's a professor of law at Case Western Reserve University in the great city of Cleveland, home to Drew Carey, which was saved about 10 years ago by Reason, if I'm remembering correctly. John actually appeared in one of those episodes. You can read his writing at The Volokh Conspiracy, which is housed at Reason.com, as well as at National Review Online. John, thank you so much for talking. I realize we've been talking for about 45 minutes, and you could have written about 1,000 blog posts in this time, because you are incredibly prolific. So I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Please subscribe to us at iTunes, at Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And while you're there, rate and review us. Again, this has been the Reason Podcast. Thanks for listening.